Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 78, we're here in Tokyo, where we'll hear a bit about politics, a lot about design, coiffed poodles, and even a bit about Japanese leading men.
I was very impressed with a film at the film festival called Postcard. The actor who plays the male lead, Atsushi Toyokawa, put in a very strong performance, one might say.
That was Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times. We'll also be crossing over to Hong Kong to hear what topped the agenda at this week's C40 workshop, Low Carbon Cities for High Quality Living.
How do you retrofit old buildings so they can be more energy efficient? And then electric mobility. But how do you do it? Putting in the infrastructure. How much is it going to cost? Who's going to start first?
That was Christine Lowe, CEO of public policy think tank Civic Exchange. And later we'll be hearing about the highlights from Tokyo Design Week from our very own design editor, Hugo McDonald.
The most interesting thing that I've seen all week has been Finland's mass exodus to Japan. 65 companies, 700 products, over 3 floors, and just presented it as this is what's happening in Finland right now.
And now, from Tokyo, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, November 7th, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Tokyo. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with our Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. And over in London, I think I hear Mr. Tuck and Mr. Bound. Hello, everyone.
Hello there. Happy lunchtime.
Hello. Hi.
I thought first I would start on this side, and you boys can jump in as and when you like. Fiona, I don't want you to give away Design Week completely, but maybe a few highlights before we bring on Mr. McDonald. How was it compared to other years?
Well, yet again, there was a typhoon, which seems to be an annual event here. I don't know what it is. I've dipped into Design Week. I had a look at the main venues, Design Tide, Designers Week. Hugo can tell us more about it. But yes, I've enjoyed it. I think I've been looking more at the smaller venues close to the office around Omotesando. It's been interesting. I mean, I think it's always a struggle for Design Week because a lot of the really big designers don't necessarily get involved. But no, what I've seen, I've enjoyed.
Well, we'll spend a bit more time on that. I'm speaking about sticking close to the office. Andrew, I imagine you by sort of Monday morning, you managed to escape.
For a few hours here and there. And also, I had one day in Madrid as well for a little project we have coming up in February. But no, this week's been about heading to the mountains finally for our winter newspaper. So that's been the thing we've been setting up all week.
Well, we've been over here. Have you had any luck either dispatching Rob or other people? Because I know that you had the very good idea of using our very underused Zurich bureau and dispatching people there.
Yes, I'm signing up people kind of for a little mountain tour. So they're getting their kind of rucksacks packed and clampons on. And we'll be hiking off in the next few days, I hope.
What he means is he's given me a barrel of rum to put around my neck like a St. Bernard.
I was going to say that, and lederhosen as well, hopefully.
Of course.
Rob, you were missed over the past few days around, not just one microphone, many microphones. We actually taught Team Lebanon. And we didn't spend a lot of time on it last week, but we had a very interesting party over here as well, which was to really kick off Beirut to Tokyo, which is where we featured the work of Nada Devis, which was at a wonderful little space called Tabloid, kind of on the harbor, which is which was interesting on hurricane night, wasn't it?
It was. I think there was a bit of panic, and we had a few phone calls from nervous guests wondering if we'd cancelled the whole thing, but it wasn't that bad in the end, was it?
Well, I know Andrew got it. Well, I think everybody got sort of the panicked SMS, email, BBM note that I sent out, because I really didn't think we were going to make it, because you don't want to get on. This is, we were getting on the aircraft to Tokyo, and I said, is, you know, the typhoon, I said, it's probably going to be close by the time we're touching down. And they said, yeah, we're going to beat it by 2 hours. And obviously the hurricane sped up, or the typhoon sped up on the way, and we landed practically in the eye of it. We sort of beat it by about 90 minutes, but it was the most unpleasant landing. In fact, we had made 2 attempts. On the third one, we made it. So here we are. I know you delight in these things, Andrew.
No. It's just that you do seem to have bad luck. You have a few kind of scary landings. And I guess that's the trouble if you fly into kind of typhoon season. But
no, and bless them as well that they didn't. They don't make any announcements either. It was, you know, if you're on maybe a British carrier, they like to sort of keep you fully, you know, apprised of what's going on. This was not the case. So I was sort of had my head sort of stuck down the aisle, sort of yelling at the flight attendant saying, could you please tell the captain to get on the horn and tell us why the hell we've taken off for a second time. Anyway, we're going to continue this conversation in a moment when we'll be catching up with the Financial Times' Gwen Robinson. But first, Hong Kong played host to Climate Dialogue last week, a series of events bringing together international community, business and policymakers developers to debate about climate change. Concluding the week was the C40 workshop, Low Carbon Cities for High Quality Living, designed to help mayors of world cities combat climate change back at home. So what was the top of the agenda? Well, Christine Lowe is the co-founder and CEO of the public policy think tank Civic Exchange, and she helped program the conference, and she joins on the line from Hong Kong. Hello, Christine.
Hello.
I guess in the context of all of the mayors who were assembled, if you could maybe just sort of outline, when you look at sort of creating this narrative, you talk about sort of low carbon cities for high quality living. How broad is it? Is it really only public sector focused, or is it also talking to private sector as well?
Well, we're focusing particularly on the cities, and city mayors in general are focused on delivering results on the ground. So it's a very particular group of people, but they know very well they can't do it all on their own. They need the private sector there, they need the professional consultants, and they need sort of members of the public, you know, the public buy-in. So the discussion really goes towards looking at two particular very important issues for cities today. One is buildings. How do you retrofit old buildings so they can be more environmentally sound and more energy efficient? And then lots of cities are thinking about electric mobility. But how do you do it? Putting in the infrastructure. How much is it going to cost? Who's going to start first? So it was a very, very rich discussion.
Where did you come up with the retrofitting topic? Because I think it's an interesting one, particularly certainly in your own hometown in Hong Kong, where this is, you know, very much a hot discussion, perhaps not even a big enough discussion. But, you know, clearly when we speak to a lot of journalists and residents, aside from the preservation point of view, people saying it's just so sad to see a lot of the city disappearing. But I think a lot of people are really getting the environmental message as well. So is that sort of targeted at the home market as much as also, I think, a lot of cities across Asia?
Well, you know, every city has lots of buildings, and some are heritage buildings, some are just old buildings, some are buildings that are obsolete, that really needs replacement, but some are well built, and you don't need to tear them down. They can have many more years of life, and then there are the new buildings. But the majority of the buildings in any city have been there for a very long time and could be there for, you know, many more decades. So the majority of the buildings, what can you do with them so that they're more energy efficient? So we're looking at generations of buildings, you know, buildings that are built in the last 10 years, 20 years. Many of these buildings are built to a certain standard, but they may not actually be operating at the design standard because, you know, we regard buildings as dead things, not sort of living organisms where if you manage them well, they can perform better. So retrofitting a building, managing a building properly are very basic and very important issues. And then there are new buildings. Of course, we want to have well-designed buildings, state-of-the-art technology, well-managed buildings, so that we can capture all the design benefits.
On that note, is the idea that you're trying to then create a script when all of the mayors head back home post-Hong Kong, that they're able to then not just go and talk to their own planners, but they're also able to go and engage with developers as well and saying, this is what we're hearing. Here's some best practice examples that we've seen in other parts of the world and then go forth from there?
Well, the mayors are here, and also in some cases the mayors are not able to come, but they've sent teams of their officials. So this gathering has people in quite a number of cities who are directly responsible for buildings and for the implementations of electric vehicles. So these guys are pretty serious because they're looking at what other cities are doing. They can learn other people's best practices. They can ask them what are the biggest mistakes that they've made so they don't have to make them. They're in the room with people who are professionals from all around the world. And, you know, this is where you can spend just a couple of days, talk to a lot of people, see a lot of ideas. Some of them are new to you. And hopefully when they go home, they can say, ah, right, you know, we know who to talk to more. And we have now some new ideas of how we can fast track what we want to do.
Can you name names when you look at cities around the world on the whole retrofitting side of things? Is anyone really getting it right where they've engaged? Obviously, certainly people on the city side, on the government side, but also have, you know, really sort of put the developers and landowners in the right space as well.
Well, we're very interested, actually, to look at how cities are doing it. For example, the city of New York, they have a big program to retrofit all their public buildings. It's at the beginning of their retrofit program. So I think the kind of questions people were interested in is, how do you verify whether what you've done, you know, you've got the result that you want? How much is it going to cost? Have you calculated the payback period, which, of course, they have? And, you know, how long is it going to be? So I think all these questions are vitally important to others. And then there are actually some questions that are non-technical. For example, we have a building in Hong Kong where the owner is going through retrofitting, but of course, owners don't really want the tenants to move out whilst they're doing this. So there's a soft side to it. How can you persuade and work with your tenants? So whilst you're retrofitting, you know, greatly inconveniencing them, and yet they stay. So there's an example that people were very interested in. So, you know, it's the hard and the soft, and people are interested, you know, if you're the people who are responsible for actually carrying it out, they're interested in the whole spectrum of what you need to do.
On the electric vehicle side and where we move with electric mobility in general, it seems... there's been really a crop of stories that have popped up recently, I guess, as we move closer to seeing more vehicles plugged in our streets, which is really, and I guess this is why you're addressing it, that a lot of, you know, certainly a lot of cities have not thought it through. It's great that people are bringing these vehicles to market, but it's still a long way off until the urban environment's ready. Is anyone ready?
I think cities are in sort of different stages of readiness, but of course you need to have the infrastructure there. There's all these questions people wanted to know, how cities are choosing as to who pays for the infrastructure. Is it the electric utilities who are paying for it? Is it the city who's paying for it? You know, who is responsible? And there are different ideas here. Different cities have chosen different ways of doing it. And then you have, and how about the vehicles? For example, in the U.S., I think cities are more interested in saloon cars. But, you know, in Asia, Asian cities are interested in electric mobility as a whole. So they're interested in buses, they're interested in electric vans. So, again, the discussions is quite diverse and very interesting.
Great. Christine Lowe in Hong Kong, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Fiona, it's when you look at Japan, and obviously of really all of the countries that are involved, probably this one has the biggest vested interest at this time. Are there any cities or any communities that you feel have got it together here yet? And is there that same sort of discussion dialogue that we've seen in certainly international press that, you know, perhaps, yeah, the urban planners are not, you know, moving as quickly as Nissan is?
It's so interesting that, because, you know, obviously Japan leads the way with electric vehicles. I mean, I think for Japan, it could be something really interesting. Tesla have just arrived in Japan, and I was talking to them about it's sort of Coles to Newcastle. They're bringing electric cars here. But they said, actually, the Japanese companies are not focusing on anything but the family car. So they're just going, there's a new market. They're thinking maybe a high end, you know, Porsche kind of buyer might be interested. But still, of course, there are electric car chargers, it's talked about, but it's not quite ready, I would say. Mm. Maybe in smaller cities like Kamakura. Tokyo is not ready yet.
I wasn't quite sure though whether, you know, this notion that, you know, all Asian cities are interested in, you know, in electric vehicles, because if I look at, I think, you know, if you look only beyond the border in Hong Kong, you know, it's BMW and Mercedes and the like. They're selling a lot of saloon cars in China.
Definitely. I mean, you know, you go onto the streets of Beijing, week by week, there are so many more cars. That's going to be their big challenge, I think. What are they going to do with all these car owners? Because the quality of the air is just disastrous already. But they've almost got to go through that stage of all buying the big saloon cars, and then maybe they'll be interested in the environmental cars. But
Andrew, have you pulled your big saloon car out of the garage in the last month?
I never move my car. It just kind of sits there now. I think the interesting thing is I think the debate is changing here in the West as well, because I think what people are realizing is, of course, it's great to have electric cars, but if they're recharged from a power point that's, you know, that's getting energy from fossil fuels, then it's still not exactly a clean way of kind of running yourself around town. And it doesn't get rid of the problem of just the number of vehicles on our streets. And I think that's, you know, the thing that lots of cities need to face up to is, you know, of course, it's great switching over to electric cars in some sense, but if you have just as many vehicles, and we see it in so many cities, especially London, where it's often like gridlock, then it still doesn't counter the issue of just, you know, getting people onto public transport and the improvements in public transport.
Well, Andrew, thanks for doing your bit, keeping a car off the road. Fiona doesn't even have one.
I don't have a car. I'm very green. Even my bicycle's not working.
I was going to say, that bicycle has yet to move from the garage to the office as well. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from Tokyo and London. We're back after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Tokyo and London. Now, before we get into full design mode, we thought we'd invite one of our favorite regulars to the program. Gwen Robinson is here from the Financial Times. Hello.
Hello, hello.
We didn't see you over the weekend, sadly.
It must have been the typhoon, Tyler.
What is dawn yoga? I received this note saying that you're off to dawn yoga. I sort of get the concept, but...
What is dawn yoga? Well,
4 a.m., 3:30?
No, it wasn't quite. It was about 6 a.m.
Right. I wonder who attends and I wonder what you wear.
You'd have to come to find out.
Okay, the chance of me in any yoga class is highly, highly unlikely.
I'll book you in.
Why don't we talk about, well, a couple of things. I thought that we should probably talk about the film festival because I got the odds dispatch from you, which sounded quite interesting. But also I think the competition that's happening. I want to talk about Haneda, which has just thrown open its new runway.
Right. But
before that, I guess to both of you, just over the last week, I mean, obviously the ongoing story about the island disputes with China, and certainly that a situation that didn't seem to be like that was getting any better. Some side discussions between the Japanese foreign minister and his Chinese counterpart. But then a story which kicked off the week, which is that Japan had penned this deal for rare earth minerals with Vietnam, and then obviously this was a huge issue for Japan Inc. because every company. Well, not every company, but certainly at the high tech end, depends, you know, certainly on these resources. Do you think that they saw it as something as a coup?
I've been following it a bit, and it's interesting that deal. But I think it's a largely symbolic thing because if you look at China's vast dominance of the entire rare earth industry worldwide, is so large that, you know, a Vietnam deal would be a tiny little, you know, speck in the rare earth ocean, so to speak. So I'd say it's largely symbolic, but it certainly has been a real, well, you know, people call it a game changer, and I think it is really in relations between China and Japan. Japan has been really reminded of its vulnerability, and whoever would have thought, who knew much about rare earths before all this happened? Now we're all experts in the vast array of products that rare earths are used in.
I also can't quite believe the fact that China has this whole market tied up, and I'm sort of looking at you, Gwen, as well. That, you know, certainly the Australians, you know, must have some kind of interest in this, you know, or even my, it's like, you know, like what are the Canadians up to? They're certainly at a similar latitude to the Chinese.
Well, indeed, one would think, you know, that Canada and Australia are both specialise in things you get out of the ground, but apparently, according to the figures, I mean, the Chinese really have it tied up, and those countries that do have little deposits are rushing to kind of, you know, mine them now frantically. But I think it'll be years before there's anyone rivaling China in supplies.
And it sort of reminds us to perhaps our not such a appropriate payoff to our People Flow Day story last week when we were talking about Chinese lifts and certainly people going down to the earth in China as well, that maybe it has something to do with the fact that maybe China has slightly different practices when it comes to extracting these things from the earth as well.
Yeah, it's clear that, you know, if you're a miner, you'd rather work for an Australian company or a Canadian company than a Chinese one. And, you know, it's terrible when there's a kind of a mining disaster in China. It certainly doesn't get the coverage when it happens in Chile, just because people expect it. And the kind of the deaths every year from mining in China are extraordinary, especially in the coal industry.
Just for a moment before we start talking about Haneda, because there's so much excitement about this airport, the Japanese, you know, certainly in the run-up to this, were very excited about, they've changed the visa laws here, so it's much easier to get all the weekend shopping traffic over that you see. But how much has this current spat dented tourism numbers? I mean, we've heard about these mass cancellations. We've heard the leaders from both ANA and JAL really complaining about the cancellations. Is that sort of just a one-off, you know, group of block bookings, or is it certainly ongoing?
Well, I was looking at that, and it seems you're talking about cancellations of Chinese tourism
inbound to Japan. Yeah.
It does seem that the vast majority of those cancellations were to do with official or semi-official. For example, I was talking to a culture ministry official the other day, Japanese, who the Japanese had a big cancellation of a huge group of school children coming over on a cultural exchange. It's those kind of things that were cancelled. From what I hear going around, you know, the Ginza and friends I've got in Hokkaido around the tourist areas, those flights are still coming in with Chinese tourists. Have you heard of large?
Well, this is what I was wondering. I mean, we heard about this, you know, whatever, you know, 4,000 cancellations, but that was probably, you know, three primary school classes in China, maybe. I'm not quite sure. But yeah. That's what I was asking, because certainly around the city over the weekend, I really felt that there was no shortage of Chinese again.
Definitely.
In and around Marunouchi, et cetera.
Yeah. Ginza and Omotesando today, I mean, crowds of people outside of Omotesando Hills.
Exactly. And I don't think the Chinese have taken any official steps to impede, you know, tourists' plans, individual tourists. Mm. They've just, where they can exercise levers of power officially, they can, you know, cancel school tours and things like that. But that's about it. It's really just the point to remind the Japanese. And it's really, we've really seen a very empowered and proactive China on this front, and I think probably the Japanese have had a bit of a shock.
I mean, there's no question of it that our favorite department stores and the retail brands we like would be in worse shape if it wasn't for the inbound traffic at the weekends.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when we looked at the new Mitsukoshi building for Monocle, we went to have a look around. The first thing I noticed getting on the escalator is the voice welcoming you is speaking to you in Chinese, which is, you know, a surprise. And definitely, you know, you go to Ginza Crossing, it's definitely Chinese tourists who are carrying the big Gucci bags and so on. You know, so they really do need them, I think.
I was talking to one of the developers, one of let's say the big three M's in the city, and they were talking about just the positive impact that the opening of the new airport is going to have. I have not flown through it yet. You toured it for the magazine. What do you make of the new international Haneda?
Well, it certainly looks great. I mean, I'm dying to try it. And now that international flights have actually started, and I think ANA and JAL were quite surprised. They were expecting 75% full flights, and actually it's much higher already. Mm. So I think they're off to a good start. It's a really interesting airport concept. It's saying, this is Japan. It's not, you know, an airport that could be anywhere else, which I found really refreshing, actually.
Well, it's interesting about the story as well is that they said there's really a program now as to, you know, they know that if they're going to compete with Hong Kong, if they're going to compete with Singapore, that they really have to make, you know, Haneda, you know, open not just sort of at odd hours for long haul international traffic. It has to be open at all times. And what, you know, and it's interesting, they talk about, you know, these two airports, Haneda and Narita, being really on equal footing. And then, you know, what happens to Narita eventually? And does it become the airport, which is going to be much more for the low-cost carriers? And it will, at a point, probably be downgraded, potentially, which is remarkable to think about. Because if you would have looked back, I guess, 20 years ago, and that's all they were doing was pushing that airport, you know, it wouldn't have happened.
They had to. There was no other alternative, no. I suppose. But
on that note, though, it's also interesting, too, when you think about everything that the competition that you have between these big three centers, and they really seem to be slugging it out, because there's been a variety of conversations, even over the last 2 days since I've been here, where it's, and I'll throw this over to both of you. Do you think that there is a new, even almost a new wake-up call that Tokyo realizes that, you know, whether it's culture, whether it's business, whether it's design, that it really has to get moving now, and that, you know, that he is really on from the likes of Hong Kong and Singapore? Not that it wasn't before, but did someone just wake up to it?
Well, I mean, talking to the people at Haneda, that was interesting, because they see Incheon in South Korea as really a big competitor for them, as a sort of regional hub airport. Yeah, I think they are. I mean, they are really waking up. And it was interesting. It was almost a fear, actually, talking to them. That was what motivated them. They all got together and said, we've got to do something
right
that will get people flying through Tokyo and not through Seoul.
Yeah. Gwen?
Well, I think the next test is in the pricing, because at the moment, just to remind listeners that Narita is what, like an hour and a half to get to. Haneda, you can roll out of bed at sort of 6 a.m., grab a taxi, and you're there in...
No, and that's what's amazing. I mean, it's easier than, you know, getting to Heathrow or, I mean...
Well, exactly.
And LaGuardia, lots of places.
That's a boon for travellers. But at the moment, because they already are running very limited international flights out of Haneda, and I take them quite a bit to China and other places, but you are paying a huge premium to fly out of Haneda at the moment. And we'll just see what the pricing structures are going to be after that, because I think that'll be a deterrent for that class of traveller that, you know, not necessarily rock bottom budget, but people who like to save money. If they're going to find it's $300 or $400 cheaper or more to fly out of Narita, then maybe the Haneda effect will be slightly.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. I was talking to someone from ANA today, and they said that it was almost impossible to use the airport today. They said they were thrilled, as you were saying, flights were full, but they said probably 70% of the people who were there, so they said it was just heaving because people just came to have a look. They said, you know, only in Japan. They said, only in Japan.
Well, they love new things.
They love
don't
new
they?
Things. And they said, yeah, they said it was, and they said also yesterday, it was like a day trip out.
Wow.
What about on the film front? Because we've just been down in Busan. They've had the film festival here. And it's one of these film festivals in Tokyo, which, it doesn't make a lot of, you know, news. Maybe it does within the region, but you certainly sort of don't hear about it elsewhere.
Well, it's very interesting you'd bring it up. And taking up on Fiona's point about comparing, say, for example, Incheon's competition with Haneda or Haneda's feeling of competition with Incheon, I think the big competitor for the Tokyo International Film Festival, as far as Asian film festivals go, is not just Busan, but several Korean festivals, which, according to all the people in the film industry here, pull great films, garner a lot of attention, big names. I think as far as Tokyo goes, this is the 23rd year that the film festival has been running. They launched it 23 years ago. And unfortunately, I think for the first, 15 to possibly 20 years of its life, it became very voguish to kind of run it down. Like, people would say, Tokyo can't organise a film festival properly. They were getting, films that weren't good enough. People always complained. And I must say it was largely commercial in earlier years and not very substantive artistically. But I was very impressed this year, and I think the spread of films was very good. They had films from all over the world and some good names. And overall, clearly they're trying very hard, and the budgets are huge compared to the compared to some of the others.
Rob, I just wanted to check in with you. So we had Alicia, who was out in Busan, and her story is in the next issue. But on the culture desk, I'm wondering how much correspondence, and certainly there's a lot of people who want us to go to the various festivals. And have you noticed there's been more of a push from the Asian side versus everything that you might get from festivals in the Americas or Europe?
Yeah, well, it was interesting reading Alicia's story from Busan, because you tend to think, we do get sent a lot of information about Asian films, but you kind of hope that it's easy for us to watch these films, maybe at the Venice Film Festival, maybe the Toronto Film Festival, the Viennale in Vienna, which is really high quality. But you hope that basically the Asian film market saves up its films for its film festivals, rather than being too good almost at distributing them to Toronto and London and so on, so that you actually, people have a reason to go to Busan, for example, or Tokyo. So they're kind of selling their own wares in their own shop front, if you know what I mean.
Just to everyone, I'm wondering, will we get to a point where it will be, someone else other than Sony? And I guess we have to remember that when Sony acquired its studios, this was an acquisition. These weren't sort of built from scratch. So you could argue that they're really the only sort of, major Asian power player who has, a production base. Rob, Gwen, do you think we'll see, the next wave out of Korea will be a big cultural powerhouse where, you won't just be watching a Samsung, you'll also be watching, a Korean-backed film, and it could be a film made in Austria, but it's by a big Korean studio. Doesn't feel like it could happen out of Japan at this point. I mean, Sony's doing their thing, and, I think they're having sort of mixed reviews at the moment. What do you think?
I've one thing, there's a lot of, great ties between Korean Americans and South Korea and LA particularly, and Seoul and Busan and LA particularly. I think there is a sort of shared knowledge and a, sort of shared power base between those two things. So I think you're likely to see Korean American co-productions coming up. And I think obviously we know the way that Korean pop culture works, and there's certainly a lot of brand tie-ups in that as well. So there's no shortage of money.
Gwen?
Well, I think it's particularly interesting in its impact on the Japanese, because what we've seen in the last few years is this incredible rise of Korean film. And also, even in popular culture, you've had this popularity of Korean male stars in particular in Japan. They, you know, it's reached fever pitch, the following amongst, well, largely female fans here. So Korean TV series and films do extremely well. Meanwhile, the Koreans are so hungry that they have, like, just ploughed money into these film festivals and into their industry. So, for example, Busan offers a prize. It's an award. Once a year, they choose a film that they will fund all the editing for and things like that, and provide the facilities in Korea, which has really drawn a lot of independent filmmakers and good quality productions. They're also offering all kinds of incentives to come there. So I think Japan feels very keenly that sort of competition. It comes at the same time that after, you know, in the 60s and 70s, Japan was producing some superb films, but its industry, I think, has gone more and more commercial. At the same time, the figures are staggering about releases of independent films. I mean, it's entirely dominated by big studios with largely commercial films now in Japan. And the Japanese independent filmmakers I was talking to at the festival were bemoaning the lack of funding for them and joking that, unfortunately, the Tokyo International Film Festival shares the same acronym as the Toronto International Film Festival. And the Japanese independents say they have to go to places like Toronto and Cannes and Venice to be able to show their films and get people interested. So I think it is a very big challenge for Japan, but I really was impressed how much better TIFF was this year, and hopefully they'll continue that next year.
Andrew, I don't want to you to give away the results of our upcoming Soft Power Index, but it's certainly going to be a big element of December, January. When you looked at, I guess, sort of the top 30 or 40 countries that we looked at, do you feel that you know, someone out there really recognizes the value, and whether it's, you know, government pushing the private sector, or whether it's the government funding it all the way? You know, we touched on, you know, sort of, you know, the rise of CCTV, and I guess you, as you know, you sort of made the point, doesn't necessarily make better news gathering, you know, versus an Al Jazeera. But when you look at, let's say, the softer side of that on the film side, do you think that any governments are getting the message that this is maybe a really good way in to having global influence?
What's interesting is I think they're beginning to recognize that in Asia, just at the point actually in Europe where it's going a bit badly wrong. What was very interesting to look in the survey was to look at a country like Italy, which traditionally had done really well with cinema as a kind of a calling card that people, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you know, they loved Italy because they got to know it through its movies. And now the average Italian movie takes €200,000 on international release, which is absolutely nothing. So it's an absolute falling away of that market. And the same here you see in the UK, in an attempt to cut money and save on budgets, the government has pulled out of its kind of backing of the film industry and has closed down some of the supposed quangos that were there to support film. I think in Europe, people have really lost the kind of the vision that you need to promote, use film to promote your country. In the US, I think they're much better at it, but then that often tends to be kind of based on various metropolitan areas doing their bit. But yeah, it's interesting. It is such a great calling card. And it is a real shame that I think that European countries on the whole don't quite know how to kind of use that anymore.
Fiona, you've been here almost as long as we've been sort of seeing the rise of all things Korean in terms of culture. So the rise of K-pop, and then what's happened in cinema, and of course all of the TV dramas as well. What is it? I mean, aside from just marketable faces, what's in it that the Japanese have embraced it, but then it's been the same for the Taiwanese and the Thais and all over the region? Why did the Korean face become the acceptable one for all of Asia, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's probably different for each market. I mean, certainly in Japan, as Gwen was saying, these TV dramas, you know, the ladies just went nuts for them. I think it was partly they were very syrupy, very romantic, which is slightly lacking in drama here. And these very soppy heroes really appealed to a market here. And I think also partly after Japan and Korea hosted the World Cup together, suddenly the pop culture world opened up. It had been very closed before then. So it was a novelty as well, you know, something new. I mean, but interestingly, I would say that wave is actually probably over, unfortunately for the Koreans.
Right.
So they need to find something new to excite the Japanese audience.
I mean, do they get fiery at all? Does anyone get slapped?
I hate to say it, but it's usually somebody dying of a terminal illness.
Oh, great.
You know, that every time I've seen one, that's usually the script. And then there's a man with bouffant hair and very white teeth who comes to save the day.
Ah, but Fiona, you've got the rise of the Korean boy bands now, yes, which is tapping into a whole new segment, you know, away from the middle.
Well, this is the world post Rain, because Rain must be pushing 50 now, I would imagine.
He's pretty young when he started, actually. I mean, poor Rain, you know, he's worked his socks off and now he's been overtaken by a crowd of other younger boy bands.
I don't know who those ones are. They're on all the posters for SoftBank now. Are they called Wave or something like that? I don't know.
It's some band with a lot of hair gel, yes, anyway.
A lot of hairstyles in general. Before we go, Gwen, you had one hot tip of, well, I guess the rising or semi-established star. A face to watch for from Japan?
Well, yes, I was very impressed with a film at the film festival, which a lot of people thought might win the award, the Sakura Grand Prize, which was $50,000, called Postcard by a 98-year-old Japanese filmmaker called Kaneto Shindo. Yes, he's 98. And by the way, in case you're wondering, he did announce when he started making this film that it would be his last. So for many reasons, including the enormous following he's got amongst the kind of cognoscenti film buffs around the world, a lot of people thought it would win. And it's a very haunting, powerful film with
Very horny for a second.
Well, it's got a very striking cast, including a couple of very good actors, and one of them in particular, I think, the actor who plays the male lead, Etsushi Toyokawa, put in a very strong performance, one might say.
Okay, I think we'll leave it at that. You're with the Monocle Weekly in Tokyo, and we're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly in Tokyo and London, where it's time for a bit of culture with Mr. Rob Bound. Hello, Rob. You still there?
I certainly am.
Are you playing with your Korean hair products?
I am.
You could use some Korean hair product. I mean, I haven't seen you for a few days, but
I think I might get a haircut this week, actually.
Okay. Well, I am off to Seoul, so I'm going to see what they've got in the aisles.
Okay. No, don't put it in your hand luggage, remember? You know in what large quantities they pack it in Korea.
No, I'll just I'll put it in a printer cartridge and I'll send it to you. what do you have for us this week?
Well, I've got a bit of an antidote to hair-gelled Korean boy bands. Kurt Wagner, who's the vocalist from Lamb Chop, the sort of post-country specialists, and Courtney Tidwell, who's the granddaughter of Slim Williamson, one of the sort of scions of Nashville country music, have made an album called Invariable Heartache, which is sort of like an ironic country title. And I don't know whether you were, I'm sort of getting the feeling you're probably Stetsoned up as usual, are you? And check shirted?
I've got some chaps on anyway.
Is Fiona in dungarees?
No, she's in pigtails though.
Oh, brilliant. Well, you'll like this then. Pippi Wilson, right?
Actually, she's got a stripy top on today.
Oh, this is going to be, you're going to love this then. This is called Picking Wild Mountain Berries. Where you been? Where you been? Same old question again. What's the use, baby? What's the use? Oh, they're never gonna turn us loose. You got dirt all over your face. Oh, and your lips get way out of place. Where you gonna tell them what we tell them every time before?
That was interesting, Rob.
That was.
Fiona, I think there could be an anthem for the whole Lojas movement over here, picking wild mountain berries. I mean, there's about 40 magazines to go with that.
Yeah, in Harajuku, still, yeah.
Exactly. Rob, I pretty like, where you been, where you been? It's that same old question again.
Absolutely. Well, we all know what the euphemism for picking wild mountain berries means, doesn't it?
Tell us over here. It's lost across the time zones.
I don't know. I think it's a bit like using the word haunting to describe a very haunty 98-year-old. Naughty Gwen.
Come on.
But so, yeah, no, I thought that was a bit more Sunday, Sunday listening than a couple of things we've been playing of late.
And the provenance of that duo again?
So, well, as I say, Courtney Tidwell is she's part of a kind of big Nashville family called the Williamsons, and this album is made of up of covers from Chart Records, which was her grandpa's record label, and they're one of the real old Nashville families. And Kurt Wagner is the vocalist from Lamb Chop, who are sort of what you might call a post-country outfit. And there's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful record.
Andrew, I wanted to ask you, we didn't spend much time on explosive devices being FedExed around the world, but it's actually been remarkable looking at the news this week. And you sort of think, oh, various leaders saying that we're going to sort of step up security measures on UPS, DHL, FedEx packages. You think, what the hell's been going on before?
Yeah, it's interesting because it comes exactly at the point when lots of airline leaders are actually pressing for a kind of relaxation of the rules. And I think that people don't quite now trust any of the measures being taken. That some of them do seem to be really just for show and kind of, you know, comfort the kind of you that something's being done. And that lo and behold, there's all these kind of packages that they suddenly realize they can't check and that are being stuffed actually on passenger planes as well as on UPS planes. So it's a funny kind of balancing point, don't you think? I wonder what's going to happen, because this kind of business of taking your shoes off and all the 100 mil thing, it doesn't seem to kind of make huge amount of sense.
No, and I think that, as you said, particularly when people sort of think that, oh, well, my FedEx package just, it's on a FedEx freighter and it never sees the cargo hold of another aircraft, that's very much not the case, because they probably don't have the biggest hub in Sana'a and elsewhere. They're not sending freighters into these places. So yeah, I'm kind of, but I was also just intrigued also how that story played out though as well over the course of the early part of the week, because it was odd. The New York Times really seemed to own it. Almost like the BBC didn't want to jump on the story. They were behind it by a few hours as well. And where, I don't know, I don't, anyone else who gets those New York Times updates, I felt like I was getting one on the hour. And the BBC thought, okay, we're going to let this one ride. And you sort of wonder, is it just because who had the correspondence on the ground, or who had, the better contacts, in the intelligence community?
I'm sure it was the contacts in the intelligence community, because that's, I think, why people feel it played out in a rather peculiar way, when it was, first of all, downplayed in the UK, for example, but then, Obama spoke out and saying it was, a very serious alert. So it just did seem to be people getting feeds, whether it was from the Saudi intelligence, but it didn't kind of add up. You're right, the beginning of the week was a very kind of peculiar time for that story.
You're with the Monocle Weekly in Tokyo, and we're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time to hear the highlights of last week's Tokyo Designers Week, celebrating its 25th anniversary and now one of the biggest contemporary design fairs in Asia. The theme this year was, wait for it everyone, environment. And exhibitors explored all aspects from ecology to climate change to how our design environments affect our bodies and minds. Our very own design editor, Hugo McDonald, was doing the rounds. How's your body and how's your mind? It's your first trip to Japan.
I know, so body and mind are a bit frazzled.
Impressions?
Gosh, where to start? It's been, quite incredible. Dogs being blow-dried has been one of my highlights.
That was in Midtown, I imagine.
Yes, and also in the bottom of Klaska Hotel. They have an amazing spa there.
Yes.
Lots of dogs stood on tables being looked after by pairs of immaculate
Japanese. You were quite
Japanese
disturbed
ladies.
By that, because you sent me a note earlier in the week and said, is it unique to this country? Fio and I spent a lot of time on this topic as well.
It's amazing, though, seeing the feet being manicured as well. Mm-hmm. And the dogs are so patient.
We do. We love seeing a little teddy bear blowout, don't we? toy poodle.
I was this place, Lotus, in I guess you'd say Lotus is Harajuku, or for coffee earlier in the week. And at the table in the window, four ladies who all had similar hairstyles, and then each of them had a dog with a different teddy bear blowout. And the dogs were all sat up on the sofa as well. And it's funny that, in a country which is so obsessed with hygiene, that the dog is actually kind of allowed, not allowed to run riot, but it was kind of interesting to see that the dog was at the dining table.
Were they wearing the dog nappies that they also sell?
No.
No, but they all had very nice dog houses, though. I mean, portable houses. I think one was Goyard.
Dog accessories I've seen a lot of in here as well.
Okay, so aside from dogs.
Lots of cakes, lots of singing, karaoke.
And more cakes.
And then more cakes and shopping.
What would have been the biggest surprises?
I think the people, actually, maybe. Well, having never been to Japan, I've only ever really experienced Japanese people on home Turf back in London, and I've been amazed how friendly and sort of open and welcoming everybody is.
You're going to get the shit beat out of when you get back to the office, because everyone's going to think, all of our Japanese staff in London are going to think, particularly nice.
No, it's less that my experience hasn't been bad in the past, it's more that I didn't expect people to be quite so welcoming.
Tell us about Design Week. I mean, you do many of these. You were at Corsair recently.
I know, this is the fourth in as many weeks.
Yeah, so?
And, I mean, it's been very interesting. I wouldn't say there's been a lot that's addressed the theme of the environment. I think they probably slapped that on, feeling like they had to have a theme, and it was quite an appropriate and ready-made one.
Right.
I mean, the one thing really that has been dealing with the environment is this exhibition at Axis Gallery by a collective called More Trees. And what they do is use offcuts of wood to make very beautiful small objects, which this time they've showed with the photography exhibition, highlighting problems of wood consumption and tree thinning and promoting tree planting. Mm. So quite standard, but the things themselves are very beautiful.
Fiona, this compared to others, and typhoons aside, I haven't been to a lot of events. In fact, I was only at our own event. I'm just wondering, is it as international? I get this sense, just being at hotels, that maybe it's not as international, but I felt other years you've had loads of Swedes and you have lots of Germans and here I was asking about British press. You didn't feel there was a lot of British press?
No, I think as far as I know, I'm the only British journalist out here. Mm.
Right.
No, it really lacks that international element. I think in past years, maybe it's just a sign of the economic times, although Finland has a big show this year. In years past, the Swedish embassy have sent crowds of designers over, so have the Danes. This year, no, not at all. And I think even, to be honest, domestically, a lot of Japanese designers aren't involved. So overall, it does feel a bit thinner than usual, I have to be honest.
This is my thought. Throughout the whole week, I haven't really been aware who it's aimed at. Because, I mean, the big names obviously aren't interested. But then they don't really seem to be catering to international press either.
Right.
There's no emphasis on traditional Japanese craft, which is what anybody who comes from abroad really wants to see. And so it's sort of left somewhere in the middle ground of sort of relatively small producers but wanting to be turned into big mass manufacturers.
Well, Fiona, you did a story on the Moruni family in the current issue, looking at, you know, various dynasties. Not that you can speak for them, but, you know, what do you think the Moruni sort of make of Design Week? And is it something like this important for them on their calendar to actually sell new products, to launch things, or they can do it outside the calendar?
I think they can do it outside. I mean, they are unusual. You know, they're deep in Hiroshima Prefecture, but they're very globally minded. They're getting out there to furniture fairs outside Japan. And I think for a lot of designers in Japan, it just isn't a particularly important date for them. And that's the sad thing, in a way, that I think the people who really are creating the identity of Japanese design, the big names, the key names, don't get involved. But someone like Moruni, you know, they are actually showing something at the moment in their own showroom. So they're slightly tweaking their display to make it Design Week friendly. They're showing a reworking of a Naoto Fukuzawa chair they have.
Right.
But, you know, I think Hugo's absolutely right. You know, if I were coming from abroad, what I would want to see is a lot of really good Japanese design.
Mm. Gwen, from a Japan Inc. side, do you think that they're missing a trick, maybe another trick, by not playing this up more, by not having, you know, certainly more of Japan incorporated, you know, doing bigger things? I mean, we often complain on one side, saying that's the problem with Milan, is that too many corporates get involved because, yeah, you know, a big car company or a big television maker, you know, wants to, you know, release their product there. But, you know, maybe does this need a bit more muscle behind it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm not a big design expert, but just I got around to see some of these things, and I agree with both of you that it seemed to be very small scale, low level, and then you had these foreigners but kind of dotted around, and then nobody, as you said, it sort of lacked a real oomph, and you kind of wondered exactly who was it aimed at. And yet, you know, Japan's got this immense tradition of design. I wonder if they're losing their way, just like we talked about with film and other things. It seems to be maybe a sort of losing focus a little on momentum, which I'd hate to see that happen, because there's still so much talent here.
I feel it's just the event that maybe is losing focus. Certainly living and working here, there's no shortage of amazing design. So in a way, that's why it's a little bit disappointing to me. I mean, I feel quite personal about it. I want Japan to show itself off in its best light. And I was talking to Hugo about this. I said, really, if you want to go and see some great design, here's a list of places you should go and look at. And actually, they're not necessarily part of any event. It's just
examples of good everyday design, which, I mean, you do see everywhere.
It's interesting, you, when you were talking, Fiona, about the big superstar names, and you mentioned Nata Fukasawa and his work, where I guess he's pretty much become sort of the unofficial official creative director in terms of giving a really a design voice to Mooney now, correct?
Yes, he has become the sort of unofficial creative director. I think, you know, they met each other in a way at a time when Naoto Fukasawa was thinking, he was, said he was thinking about wood. I mean, he wanted to he wanted to make something in wood, and they were just the right company at the right time. But I think, you know, really, Naoto Fukasawa is the unofficial sort of creative director for Japan now. Mm. I mean, every festival he's there, and his kind of low-key style really, well, you know, works. Mm. I think it represents
That's
Japan
what people
very
were
well.
Saying in Milan earlier on in the year, that, or what he was saying, actually, he launched more products than any other designer. Mm. And he said that so many brands around the world like his way of working because he gets straight to the root of a brand, and at a time when brands are a little bit confused and maybe lost their way, they see him as quite a sort of key player to come in and help them refocus.
Mm, well, with the colder months upon us, I like the look of what's sitting in front of you. Well, this speaking of Fukasawa, this what is this little
product that he launched very quietly with no party or not even a notice to say that it was new in his Plus Minus Zero shop. And it's an infrared heater, which only costs £30, which compared to everything else in that brand is quite exceptional.
Yeah.
But it's made in China.
Well, I guess these things have to be made in China, don't they? But it looks, Andrew, you need one of these under your desk. It's sort of just something to sort of keep your toes warm.
It's like looking into a toaster from above.
No, it is. It is. But I wonder, is the back, is this is just reflective, or is it actually painted orange? Because it almost looks...
It's reflected.
It is reflected. Yeah. It's very lovely.
It is. It's beautiful.
Very nice. I bet it doesn't work outside Japan.
No, it doesn't. That's the thing.
Did
it
you
takes
ask?
About 3 years. Yeah.
Well, I'll be enjoying it in Tokyo. No, sorry.
But aren't you surprised that, you know, here's a good example where plus minus you see the odd accessory that they do, which might run on batteries that they might export. But I mean, otherwise, but here's an incredible concept that resides in these borders.
It's taken 5 years for them to get their first domestic appliances kind of compatible with EU electricity.
And they chose the humidifier, which I have to say is not particularly
just what everyone wants.
Anyone is dying to have it.
But going back to the whole country branding thing, I mean, the most interesting thing that I've seen all week has been Finland's mass exodus to Japan. And
really?
They've taken 65 companies with 700 products over three floors. And it's everything from wind farms to technology to jewellery to fashion to the most essential Finnish craft, and just presented it as this is what's happening in Finland right now, and taking it to Japan to sort of update what the Japanese think happens in Finland.
Well, you were just there for us doing the Finland survey, and at the time, of course, you hadn't been to Japan yet, and I was perhaps sort of warning you that you would see a lot of similarities. And do you? Have you sort of noticed that there is this potentially great tunnel between the two?
From a design point of view, but also, I don't know, it's a sort of sensibility, I think, that spills way over from design into character. And
I wonder actually what happens like when one country is sort of on the eastern edge of Russia, and that's what happens when one is on the western edge of Russia. That
wouldn't read too much.
Everything's sort of been informed by what's sitting in the middle. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Andrew, Tuck.
Hello.
I just wanted to go back to two things. One, to the Finland survey, but before that, our soft power index as well. And I'm just wondering, when you're working on that, how much you felt that, you know, design also played into the mix when you were looking at metrics. I mean, of course, design is, as an export in its broader sense, is very hard to measure. But you know, when you looked at France, you know, versus Japan, versus in Australia, how much does that figure?
Well, it's interesting because I think actually some of the Nordic nations, especially, are kind of latching onto the idea of design as being a very good calling card that kind of shows a softer side to your country, but also is a good introduction for business. If you get a kind of a reputation for being the country that in all sorts of ways can design solutions, then people like you. So Norway is deliberately attaching a kind of design brand to its national brand. It wants to be seen as a nation of designers, perhaps slightly jealous of the kind of success that already Finland and Sweden have had in past years. But it's a very deliberate plan to use design to sell the country.
Hugo, if you could bring one thing back to tip the scales, what would it be?
Probably, I mean, any number of the Japanese craft. I don't think I've ever seen craft anywhere else in the world that's of that scale. and across such a huge range as well. I mean, it's not just a beautiful wooden spoon. It's amazing crockery, cutlery, pans.
That was amazing. I was staying at this wonderful ryokan down on the Izu Peninsula, and what all of these places do brilliantly is that they upsell you. So you've already spent a small fortune staying there. And then when you leave, they just have the most wonderful hinoki plank, which might be, I don't know, you know, 6 meters long. And it's just filled with the most amazing objects from the region. And it's yuzu jam. And then they've got, you know, fantastic, there's always fantastic spoons. And then it's just, there's great fabrics. And then before you know it, you've almost spent the room night again, just on various knickknacks. They always nail you on the body soap because they've always got a unique body soap.
Yeah, charcoal well. Body soap. I always buy some charcoal body soap and never use it. But
anyways, perhaps probably time to go enjoy a bit of that. We're back in a moment. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Tokyo and London, where it's almost time to say goodbye. Before you say goodbye to Japan, Hugo, anything else you want to see?
Well, I'm
more dog salons?
But no, I could look at them forever, actually. But I'm going on the bullet train to Kyoto tomorrow to stay in 9 hours hotel.
Are you going to do 9 hours?
Yes, which good. I'm really looking forward to.
Sabina, our finance director, will be thrilled about that. Cheapest way to go. Almost.
I'm actually paying for it myself.
Oh, good. You're more happy. Gwen, you, yeah. what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm looking at the evolution of kaiseki quiz amidst, I should say, that my main gig is writing about finance and business worldwide.
Yeah, everyone got that. But, no, I was picking up on the kaiseki. It continues.
Yes, it does continue, and I'm finding out a lot of interesting things about how young chefs no longer want to sort of submit themselves to years of sort of brutalization and cleaning toilets and gutting fish before they're even allowed to touch food. So I think there's a really big shift going on in the world of traditional Japanese cuisine. And that is one area I can safely say is really just booming. I think Michelin's just launched its 2011 guide for Kyoto, and it's this month later is going to launch the 2011 guide for Tokyo, which is going to be expanded to include Kamakura and Yokohama. So it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think more and more people internationally are paying attention to Japan, at least on the food front and design and other things, if not film. And
Fiona, we tried a great new izakaya. It was about time to add a new one to the mix in the Hiro District. Three great guys running this place. And do you, not that we chatted with them at length, but do you think that they went at, or they grew up through the system that Gwen's talking about, that they probably were classically trained and just said, I mean, there's so many places like this that we see in the city at the moment, which is amazing, which these places are never going to get a Michelin star. They don't want a Michelin star. They're just the places that we love to go here. And I'm wondering, this generation of young entrepreneur, chef, owner, because that was interesting. I thought, are these guys backed by a group? They said no. They said, this is our restaurant. We're doing it on our own. What do you think? Is there a frustration on the part of those people because they've been through the old system, or no, they're just going out and doing it on their own?
No, I mean, I'm sure they've been through the system, but I mean, the good thing is, you know, they're still young and they could turn out this amazing food. So, I mean, the system works in some ways, doesn't it? Because they produce this fantastic food. I mean, what was unusual about them is they were three guys from Kyushu who'd come up to Tokyo and, you know, they were doing something really interesting and wearing pretty amazing outfits, I
fantastic.
Have to say.
I like those kind of florally tops that they were in.
Yeah, one was in sort of cherry blossom. Another was goldfish. I don't know what.
Yeah. No,
it's sounding really intriguing.
No, it worked. Gwen, you would love it.
Gotta go.
Boys, are you hungry over there? Because we're about to head out for an early dinner here.
I'm so starving. Yeah, now you mentioned that.
Well, listen, we'll get you over before Christmas, hopefully.
I've got to make my appointment. I've got a meeting with the Quiet Girls. I'm thinking the only
bring your poodle.
The only exactly.
Rob always brings his poodle.
I need a good blowing out.
Okay, that's enough. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills. I said shoo, that was almost Welsh for Alex. In London, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp. We'd also like to say a big thank you to everyone at TAC Studios here in Tokyo. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our mono column on our site. Next week, we're back in London, but for now, from Tokyo, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Hugo McDonald.
I'm Fiona Wilson.
And I'm Gwen Robinson.
And in London, who's there?
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Band.
Goodbye.